I'd now like to ask Malcolm Kemp to introduce his paper, Risk Management in a Fair Valuation World. Malcolm.
Thank you very much. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for this opportunity to present my paper on risk management in a fair valuation world. The meeting is, of course, your meeting. You're free to discuss whatever you like rather than what I'd like you to talk about in the context of the paper. What I get to do is to write the paper itself, and also try and come up with a few themes that I think are relevant and to undertake some crystal ball gazing. The most obvious piece of crystal ball gazing within the paper is, of course, to assume that this concept of fair valuation will over time be in the ascendancy. If I turn the clock back maybe 10 or 20 years, I think that may well have been an assumption that you would have thought bold, but if you just sort of put it the other way around and say that I'm in support of market inconsistent techniques and unfair valuations, I think you can see just how unlikely it is that this particular trend will not continue moving forwards. You've got Basel II for banks, the EU's Solvency II program for insurance companies, new accounting standards for pension schemes, and new FSA rulebooks, and they all are pointing in this direction. We haven't reached that destination where fair valuation is everywhere, but if you agree with me that this is where the journey is actually going, then it seems to me that actually there will be some fairly fundamental changes along the road in the way in which we think about risk, we measure it, and we manage it. And it's my view that this will actually fundamentally alter the actuaries' tools of the trade, and even maybe what that trade is and who does it. Take, for example, defined benefit pension schemes. Three particular messages from the paper are, if you look at it from 60,000 feet, most closed or at least even open mature pension schemes don't look a whole heap different to insurance companies, and yet they are regulated in two different ways. At least they are in the UK. They're not in the continent. So it seems to me that there will be almost inevitably some kind of harmonisation between those two, whether it's pension funds moving towards insurance companies moving towards pension funds, or them meeting in the middle. A second message that the paper comes up with is that the old evaluation methodologies and the like that the fair valuation techniques are replacing are tended to involve more smoothing. And so, not too surprisingly, the growth in fair valuation is likely to highlight more the asset liability mismatches that exist within defined benefit pension schemes. And no wonder that there is this enthusiasm for the concept of liability-driven investment. And a final message that the paper has for defined benefit pension schemes is the degree of exposure that underfunded ones have to the creditworthiness of their employer. This risk is, as I'm sure you've all appreciated, opened up not over a whole long length of time, but during that time there's been an equally interesting feature of the financial markets that's also come along, which is an explosion in the size and the use of credit derivatives. And this is a market that's specifically focused on transferring credit risk. It seems to me that to date there hasn't been a huge interaction between those two things, but that there is some ripe opportunities there for the two to become closer linked. And that means that understanding credit risk and those kinds of issues will, I think, become more important for actuaries going forwards. Similar, although not identical, messages are contained within the paper for insurance companies. A lot of them have already significantly de-risked themselves, and at least they have in terms of their market risk. And that's actually brought up their agenda, things like credit and liquidity risk, which I think ties in with the point I've just made about credit risk. I hope that the section in the paper that focuses on that, which is in the middle in section 9, will prove helpful for those of you who managed to get to it, particularly for those within the insurance sphere. The current regulatory regime does claim to be market consistent, but in my opinion doesn't achieve that fully when it comes to credit risk. Section 9 contains material on a number of things that actuaries may be less familiar with, things like credit collateralised default, or collateralised debt obligations, CDOs for short. And it might seem relatively technical to some readers, but please do bear with it if you have a chance. The section does demonstrate that really there's no fundamental difference or inherent distinction between market and credit risk, in that these new types of vehicles, the CDOs, although typically they express views on credit, they can use the same kind of technology can be used with any other sort of risk, and so there's no fundamental reason why you should view the two separately. It also shows that reliance on credit ratings, which is the way in which the current regulatory tests operate, isn't ultimately an appropriate way to frame market-consistent capital adequacy standards. The CDO debt that is issued is typically rated by credit rating agencies, but you have this interesting question: does a rating of, say, AA for that particular sort of bond correspond to a AA rating for any other sort of bond? And in that section, my argument is that they don't, and therefore you need to focus more on things like credit spreads and other intrinsic measures of risk that come from the market rather than from credit rating agencies. The paper also has, in my view, important messages for risk management professionals themselves. It talked about market consistency and its link with fair valuation. Ultimately, it seems to me, having looked through this and in the process of writing it, it seems to me that if you want fully market consistent risk modelling, then you can't use the tools that are typically used to date in terms of risk management and risk measurement, which are typically focusing more on historic time series and extrapolating them into the future. To do anything else ultimately contradicts some of the key axioms that need to be present for the mathematics to work. And if that thing is true for risk modelling, then it's also true for a number of other areas where actuaries get involved, things like risk budgeting and asset liability modelling. Asset liability modelling of the sort that you see for pension funds and insurance companies. When I first started thinking about this paper, the thing that I was going to pursue was why it is that the term asset liability modelling means a completely different thing outside the actuarial profession to what it means inside the actuarial profession. And although there are certainly many good uses for asset liability modelling, it does seem to me that if one follows through the details and the mathematics, you find that they are not necessarily quite the panacea for all ills that you might otherwise have believed from even things like actuarial guidance notes and the like. It's more tricky to formulate them so that they truly are market consistent, and it's more tricky to come up with objective rather than subjective assumptions than it first looks. Which kind of brings me to the paper's messages for actuaries. And I guess the key message is that there, in fact, isn't really a message. And by that, I mean that actually there's very little in the paper that specifically focuses on actuaries. The point here is that a fair valuation world, is ultimately no respecter of professions. what you do to work out the fair value, at least in theory, is you go away and observe it in the market, and that's not something that is exclusively actuarial in nature. This poses, in my opinion, some opportunities and threats for the actuarial profession. It will be up to you to seize the former and sidestep the latter, and I hope my paper does provide you with some clues as to how to do so. One final point within the paper is that not only is fair valuation no respecter of professions, but it doesn't seem to me it's any respecter of national boundaries either. And this, it seems to me, does have some interesting implications for how actuarial professions or other professions think about themselves and structure themselves in the world and in different countries. But when I got to this stage, I'm afraid my crystal ball ran out and became rather cloudy. So I look forward to finding out how the actuarial profession will deal with this particular one in the years to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Malcolm, for a very interesting paper. I have no idea how you found the time to write so much all on your own. For everyone else, I work in the insurance practice of Lehman Brothers, and I focus on the asset liability management solutions, sort of implementing those solutions. This paper touches on a vast array of topics related to this, but primarily it highlights the fact that the various components of risk can actually be separately identified and therefore separately managed. A company's at many different stages of implementing the risk monitoring and management practices, so I hope this will help them to see what is possible in the future. Perhaps the biggest discussion around the theoretical attraction of fair values is the use of an equity risk premium in pension fund valuation. Now, it may be useful to compare the equity risk premium to the cost of hedging the downside risk in equities. So, therefore, to keep the risk premium is and not hedge is therefore, by definition, taking risk. So, therefore, for me, that just becomes a part of risk budgeting, which I'll come on to. In section three, Malcolm talks about group risk and how he sort of separates that out from the market risk. But I wonder whether in a fair value framework you could actually link that somehow to the own idiosyncratic risk factor of a company. In section four, it states that derivatives are becoming increasingly used. We certainly see that a lot on the investment banking side. We create indices of risk-free investments, which can then serve as benchmarks. We can create swaps which then link to these benchmarks, and particularly in the liability-driven investment world for pension fund management, we see a large move to using swaps as overlays from existing benchmarks to a liability benchmark. Section 4.6 suggests we could treat future contributions to a pension scheme as a form of a corporate bond issued by the parent company. I think this is a great idea. If pension funds did this, they would be able to treat the single name risk of the pension fund parent as just part of their portfolio. You could then reduce the overall risk to it by using CDS, or just the overall risk of the industry by changing your investment strategy. Section 4.7 also talks about insurance company buyout quotes being a correct fair value to use for pension fund valuation. I think in that we need to take account that there will be additional regulatory capital and also shareholder profit, which will need to be incorporated in that. And I think that may stop pension funds and life insurers coming together exactly. Sections 5 to 7 look at risk measurement, particularly historic versus future risk factors, and suggest that implied data or the market data should be more relevant than the historic. And the question there is obviously, is the current view of the market risk better than the historic view? At the end of the day, it's the asset manager who will use their skill with this risk measure to make trading decisions. Therefore, any risk measure used must be objective and realistic. In section 6.4, Malcolm identifies a conceptual split in the return behaviour into several parts. The Lehman Global Risk Model, which I'm not trying to sell, does exactly this. It assigns the risk to movements in over 300 global systematic factors: currencies, treasury yields, swap spreads, volatility, inflation, credit spreads, bucketed by rating and industrial sector. And then finally uses historical data to analyse the absolute values of the residual return that aren't explained by any of those other factors. And then you end up with a covariance matrix with 300 elements in, which we then have to simplify and adopt the core factor approach Malcolm uses in 6.3.7 to actually simplify the covariance matrix. The portfolio manager then can weight the historic data to more recent market events, which does begin to get to the fair value approach. In section 7.2, Malcolm suggests we can derive equity idiosyncratic risk from the implied volatility of options trading on each name. Now, this market is definitely becoming more liquid, and hedge funds do indeed trade dispersion trades where they bet index implied volatility against all the individual name implied volatility. But the problem, as Malcolm says, is the data quality in this, and his suggestion could be interesting, but implementation is not at all obvious to me. Section 8.3, risk budgeting, is the area I see of most relevance to the actuarial profession. We see a lot of interest in the concept of asset manager skill. I think this will become a lot more relevant as investment consultants and risk managers start analysing the components of risk. It'd be interesting to know how many credit managers have actually outperformed their benchmark by taking duration bets, not credit bets, and how much risk was therefore actually taken. Various models can help you identify this skill through performance attribution systems. And I think the implications of this are going to become very relevant for the actuarial profession to actually take these risk factors, identify managers who have particular skill in different managing different risk factors, and therefore in being able to optimise the risk budgeting process. I did get to section 9, and I do agree with Malcolm that CDOs have helped us to think of credit risk as just another market risk, which can be altered and changed via the capital structure of a CDO, i.e. you can change the individual name risk to more of the market systematic risk just by taking different tranche of the CDO. And just for the avoidance of doubt, a CDO is not a derivative, it's just a capital structure. So it appears that the CDO technology is here to stay and will become an important tool in this risk management. I particularly like Malcolm's idea in section 9.6 of looking at a life company as a CDO. And I think this is particularly revealing in understanding who is really taking the risks. I would suggest extending this theory to actually incorporate the fact that different policyholder liabilities are effectively different tranches sitting above the debt. For example, a ring-fenced with-profit fund would mean they would sit at the top of the capital structure, whereas maybe a non-profit, long-dated liability, i.e. annuities, should perhaps just sit above the Tier 2 debt that's been issued, because they are the people supplying a lot of capital into the structure, and they are bearing a lot of the market risks. And perhaps this explains why an annuitant should expect to receive a higher than a risk-free return. Section 10 discusses liquidity risk. Why does an insurer or pension fund hold gilts? I mean, why does it hold it at all? Does it need the liquidity? Does it need the security for members or policyholders when it itself is a triple or a double A rated entity? And it also brings back the argument about risk-free rates. You can indeed now trade CDS and hedge out all credit risk. So you could buy a pool of credit hedge out the credit risk through CDS, and in which case you will keep the swap spread premium. So therefore, what risk do you have? Should you be using gilts as risk-free rate or maybe the swap rate? What of the future? In section 12, Malcolm identifies this area as a new field for actuaries. I totally agree with this view, particularly in the risk budgeting, the monitoring of asset manager skill, scenario testing, and liability-driven investment. Implications of identifying and understanding the risk factors better will enable better capital optimization for insurance companies. However, there will remain conflicts between the different capital constraints. Will equity and credit managers eventually be the same people? Some investment banks have already merged their departments, and hedge funds are certainly arbitraging the capital structure. So it does look like we're heading that way. So looking into the crystal ball with Malcolm, I can also see that fair valuation will continue to expand. Certainly gone are the broad brush asset allocation splits that I certainly studied in my actuarial exams.
Speak this evening. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, good. I have one or two people who've notified us in advance that they'd like to speak, and I'll invite one of those, Chris Lewin, if he'd like to open the discussion.
Good evening. This is an interesting and useful paper. However, I believe it fails to explore sufficiently one of the most important aspects. In section 232D on page 12, the paper introduces the idea of intrinsic values. I should like to say why I regard the difference between fair value and intrinsic value as being one of the key risks which needs to be managed in a fair valuation world, particularly when the difference is large. Perhaps I should say at once that intrinsic value has a degree of judgment in its evaluation which is not normally present in fair value. This does not mean, however, that intrinsic value is any less important than fair value. Let me try and define what I mean by intrinsic value. It is the average value which one would expect a representative group of long-term investors to place on an asset or on a market if they were influenced only by considerations of fundamental future returns. Intrinsic value, therefore, takes account of future income and future capital receipts, as well as the risk attaching to the level of those future receipts, including the possibility of default. Differing individual long-term investors will make different calculations of intrinsic value, which is why I speak of the average value derived from a group of such investors. It should be noted that my definition leads to a value which does not necessarily represent the value of the investment to the specific individual investor, which may be influenced by a range of considerations that are not experienced by the market as a whole. It is common experience that fair value quite often differs from intrinsic value. For example, the fair value of the equity market in 1999 vastly exceeded its intrinsic value, as some commentators at the time bravely pointed out. These commentators looked at the yields obtainable on equities and concluded that, in fundamental terms, they were unsustainable. Similarly, the fair value of the Scottish housing market during the 1990s, when house prices were much lower than in the rest of the UK, was less than the intrinsic value at that time. Both of these distortions in fair value were since corrected, with fair values reverting to figures which were much closer to the intrinsic values current in 1999. It is important to take into consideration why fair value may differ substantially from intrinsic value for a long period of time. Suppose, for example, that there has been a bull market in equities for the last 2 years, at some point, with little sign of it easing just yet. Those investors in the market who take short-term positions will evaluate the chance that equities will be higher or lower in, say, 3 months' time, if that's their time horizon. If they believe that there is, say, a 70% chance that the bull market will continue for at least another 3 months, it makes logical sense for them to invest, even if they believe that current fair values exceed current intrinsic values. Long-term investors may be more wary of purchases if they too believe that current fair values exceed current intrinsic values. The market will therefore go on being driven up mainly by short-term investors until, eventually, many short-term investors start to believe that the 70% chance of a rise in 3 months has become 50% or less. The market will then crash as the rise in fair values falters and more short-term investors start to bail out. Because of general uncertainty at that time, the crash may reduce fair values in the short term to less than intrinsic values, though there may well be a reversion to intrinsic values a little later. The important point here is that fair values can quite logically differ from intrinsic values for an extended period, even if virtually the whole market recognizes in one way or another that this is the case. But that eventually, fair values will often tend to move closer to intrinsic values. Intrinsic values, just as much as fair values, are therefore of importance to both short-term and long-term investors, though for different reasons. What is it that may change the perceptions of short-term investors about the three-month outlook? Firstly, of course, there may be their own perception that fair values have departed too far from intrinsic values to be sustainable. Media commentators, brokers' circulars, and fashion may also play a part. So could a sudden increase in uncertainty, for example, as a result of a war breaking out. Or there may be a feeling that long-term investors are about to move huge sums into or out of the market, for example, for regulatory reasons, or because their collective asset positions are beginning to differ substantially from their desired long-term asset distribution. So, how can one evaluate intrinsic value? My suggested approach would be to look at the fundamentals of yield, PE ratios, likely earnings growth, expected risk premium, etc., and work out what would seem to be an appropriate current fair value for a group of long-term investors, assuming that supply and demand were in balance and that there were no short-term investors in the market. This calculated fair value, admittedly based on assumptions and judgment, would be regarded as the current intrinsic value. Once the intrinsic value has been calculated, the differences between it and the current fair value can be exploited by long-term investors, particularly those who are relatively unconstrained by liability considerations. The resulting strategic moves they make can be regarded as risk reduction rather than taking positions for speculative reasons. They will lighten their holdings in an overvalued market in order to reduce their risk of loss. And they will increase their holdings in an undervalued market in order to reduce the risk of being out of it when it performs comparatively well. Their timing will crucially depend on their assessments of when future movements in fair value will occur, though this is notoriously hard to predict accurately, and they will seldom get their timing exactly right. Averaging their strategic moves over a period of several months will probably reduce their regret risk. Thus, I hope I have convinced you that fair value and intrinsic value are both important to investors, and that the difference between them can either be a major source of risk or a strategic opportunity. For the same reason, this is very important, I think, for the same reason, fair values will not necessarily be the most important yardstick to use in judging the solvency of a financial institution, even though current fashions are leading us in that direction. Finally, I suggest that the accountants and regulators have been very clever in calling market values fair values, suggesting that these are somehow preferable to other values. For similar reasons, I suggest that instead of intrinsic values, we should use the expression true values. Thank you.
Martin White.
Martin White. Like the previous speakers, I thought this paper was excellent. Clearly very carefully written, and it deserves similarly careful reading. Most of the material relates to the risk management of financial institutions, many of whom are concerned with keeping their own risks within strict limits, with the balance of the real risks being carried by the underlying clients, usually long-term individual long-term savers or investors of some kind. But I found the analysis to be relevant to many areas of financial life, and I'm going to talk very briefly on a number of these. Most of the time, I'm coming from the perspective of a direct long-term investor who's not bothered if share prices vary hugely, providing the underlying companies do sufficiently well. So I think I'm interested in Chris Lewin's intrinsic value. His comments bring to mind Ben Graham's observation along the lines of the market being a casino in the short term and a weighing machine in the long term. I'll cover four aspects. I'll state them first and then come back to talk a little more on each. First, shedding light on situations of self-delusion. Fair value financial reporting should not be the driver for properly recognising economic reality and managing risk accordingly, but in practice it may be. Second, fair value is a vital stage in the evaluation for solvency purposes of investment insurance companies, insurance liabilities and reinsurance assets. Third, on derivatives as financial weapons of mass destruction. Some thoughts on getting some comfort regarding the macro picture, i.e. whether or not there's a black hole to be revealed when the world's financial statements are added together properly. Fourth, on fees, expenses and the paradox of unit trust and investment trust pricing, and the potential role for the profession in explaining some financial facts of life to the world and thus to the investing public. Self-delusion. There are a number of areas in which financial reporting has not in the past reflected economic reality. Sometimes this has been intentional, in which case a trend towards fair valuation should shame people into recognising reality. But where it has been unintentional, putting on fair value spectacles will help reveal what economic reality is. Use of fair values in solvency regulation. I thought paragraphs 2210 and 242 were particularly interesting. I support the author's conclusion that fair value concepts have an important part to play in solvency regulation. I've been very concerned for many years at the games people have played with the accounting and solvency treatment of outward reinsurance in particular. I'd have worded para 2210 slightly differently to indicate the French government's concern over having to admit the low levels of solvency capital present in some cases. Changing the accounting doesn't in itself change economic reality. And para 242 on untraded assets and liabilities is highly relevant to the determination of values to adopt. For solvency purposes, if a quoted market value is not available for an asset or liability, that, I suggest, increases the need to err on the side of caution for both. Derivatives. The black hole, if there is one, would not be revealed simply by asking everyone on either side of a derivatives contract to use fair values. For unquoted contracts, which I understand to be of immense significance, there must be huge scope to err slightly on the side of caution or optimism. At any moment, every contract must be an asset to one person and a liability to another. But if both recognise it as an asset, and that could be, on balance, what's happening across the world as a whole, we would indeed have a huge unrecognised hole, where the accounting gives an illusion of more wealth than really exists. If such a hole does exist, and is permitted to get deeper, a major adjustment, to use a gentle term, will one day emerge. Hence, I think, the term financial weapons of mass destruction. I think this could be tackled with sufficient political resolve. If all unquoted contracts were registered with the local regulators, That means local regulators have to work together around the world. And estimated assets and liabilities allocated to each counterparty, reported by each counterparty to those regulators as at a fixed date each year, such as 31st December. The regulators would at least be able to add up to see whether 2 and 2 did indeed add to 4. Finally, on the overriding importance of expenses in investment management, I start with the assertion that fund management is a negative sum game. And the option exists for underlying clients to hold shares directly, including virtually no cost of holding in the process. Fair value suggests that in the absence of strong evidence of enduring fund manager skill, an investment trust should be valued at below the market value of the underlying investments, effectively reducing it, reflecting the discounted value of future management charges. And discounts are what we tend to see in practice. If a financial institution were to hold shares in a retail unit trust or similar managed fund with generally larger total costs and charges than investment trusts, and if we also assume that that financial institution is not able to sell the units and extract its capital for a number of years, the fair value of that holding would be very substantially below the market value of the underlying investments. The optimum action would be to liquidate the holding. So what does that say about the quality of the advice which leads individual clients to invest in vehicles with high charges? In aggregate, charges matter much more than any likely performance deviation, and the investing public needs the option of bypassing advice and going for very low cost options. Thank you.
Mike, I think you had your hand up. Mike, it did.
Mike Kipling. I too would like to thank Malcolm for his magnum opus. It takes us from the vastness of 100-dimensional vector space to the more homely territories of equity land and bond land. It covers most of the familiar fields in which actuaries work, drawing attention to many similarities between them, but also to similarities with other experts' fields, which serves as a warning bell. It highlights regulatory anomalies in life insurance, particularly the inconsistent treatment of credit risk between the two peaks of Pillar 1 and between Pillar 1 and Pillar 2. There is a European-wide opportunity to get this right with Solvency II, but preliminary signs appear not to be favouring a market-consistent approach. The author defines insurance risks widely in, I can't read my writing here, whichever section, 3.1.1, I think, and again in section 11. It is clear that he includes financial guarantees under this heading. In FSA's risk classification, insurance risk is rather more restricted. Mainly it refers to the uncertainty around claims frequency and size in both life and non-life insurance. For life insurers, these are mainly mortality, including longevity and morbidity risks. In addition, persistency risk is typically included here, being more akin to a decrement outside the insurer's control than to an error-type operational risk, although it can have elements of both. I agree with Malcolm that the expense risk is probably misclassified, although inflationary elements of expense risk are more akin to market risk than to operational risk. Whilst on section 11, I fully endorse the author's suggestion in 11.2.5 that the broad risk of increased population longevity cannot easily be accommodated by either insurers or pension funds, that it must be absorbed by the population as a whole, possibly by the rather politically unwelcome increases in retirement age. Insurers can then restrict themselves to the individual risk of outliving or predeceasing the norm, and pension funds to encouraging savings. Turning to the vexatious question of defining the risk-free rate, as Mark has already referred to, I have to confess to having had something to do with the GN45 definition referred to in the paper, which is generally closer to gilts than to swaps. Perhaps there was a little fence-sitting, or, as I prefer to see, astute committee chairmanship in that definition. Nevertheless, it's good to see a new way of looking at the question using a credit default swap pricing approach. I'm sure that the groups tasked in bringing GM45 to full due process this year and the small group looking at cross-discipline consistency will both be considerably interested. Finally, I note that the average distance apart of two random points in a 10-cube in 100-dimension space is 41. In the light of the new film, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it's a shame that the answer could not have been rounded up to 42.
We have a written contribution from Ivor Kenner, and I'll ask the Honorary Secretary to read it out.
Ivor sends his apologies for not being able to be here tonight. As stated in, in paragraph 2.3.1a, fair valuation is conceptually the most appropriate way to value assets and liabilities for solvency purposes. The question is whether one needs to value assets and liabilities for solvency purposes if there is no intention of winding up a pension scheme and securing the benefits with an insurance company. One firm of consultants used to value liabilities on an ongoing notional discontinuance basis in order to obtain a recommended funding rate. In order to provide an acceptable answer to the customer, he used to be offered a choice of funding rates based on nil, 3% and 5% notional pre-award escalation of benefits. Market values of unmarketable liabilities are subjective. Market values of assets are volatile, depending upon supply and demand. Fair valuations are also likely to be volatile and not particularly safe either. An ongoing pension scheme consists, at a particular time, of a stream of payments in and a stream of payments out. These streams of income and expenditure may be valued at a consistent rate of interest, and any divergences picked up at the next valuation. There is, of course, no harm in doing a discontinuance valuation as well in order to reassure the customer and the authorities. Equating liabilities to market values, however, is just about as reasonable as offering to extinguish a lump sum debt by a series of market-related payments.
Do we have any other contributions from the floor? There's one at the back there.
I'd like to begin by thanking Malcolm for the paper, which I will reply to in the length that it clearly deserves. There are just two very simple points that I'd like to make in the course of this presentation. The first is this Orwellian abuse of fair value. Fair value you define in the paper as mark to market. This isn't fair value. The value of an asset is not its market value, other than under very specific circumstances. The value of any asset is actually a function of its use. In the course of the paper, you describe analysts as having asked for market valuation. This isn't actually true. I chaired the European Federation of Financial Analysts Committee on Methods and Measures, which was the relevant body and actually the body which replied to the Accounting Standards Committee at the time. We are in favour of fair value. That's motherhood and American pie. It's not mark to market. The fundamental difficulty that we had with mark to market is one which has been well known in financial economics and economics more generally for at least 40 years. And that is that we don't know the probability measure under which these prices are derived. The only thing that we know about the probability measure under which these prices are derived is that it results in volatility in market prices, which we cannot explain in terms of fundamentals. That is genuinely problematic. Now, in the area of derivatives, it's not a problem because we're using the same measure and it's comparable. This is Harrison and Krapps and all of that related literature. Perhaps you should have been aware of, but as it's not in your bibliography, you should have read a paper which is recently published by the London School of Economics by the Financial Markets Group, the title of which is Marking to Market, Panacea or Pandora's Box. The authors are Plantin, Sapra and Shin. If you'll indulge me, I'll just read you the abstract. Financial institutions have been at the forefront of the debate on the controversial shift in international accounting standards from historical cost accounting to mark-to-market accounting. We show that the trade-offs at stake in this debate are far from one-sided. While the excessive conservatism in the historical cost regime leads to some inefficiencies, marking to market may lead to other types of inefficiencies by injecting artificial volatility that degrades the information value of prices and induces suboptimal real decisions. We construct a framework that can weigh the pros and cons. We find that the damage done by marking to market is greatest when claims are 1, long-lived, 2, illiquid, and 3, senior. These are precisely the attributes of the key balance sheet items of banks and insurance companies, to which I would add an aside, and also pension funds. Our results therefore shed light on why banks and insurance companies have been the most vocal opponents of the shift to marking to market. I think it's a paper that the profession would do well to read in detail. But I will reply to the overall paper because I do think there are a number of intrinsically good ideas in there. The problem is really this question of marking to market. It quite clearly is not fair value, other than in an Orwellian sense. Thank you.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Tim Sheldon. I too would like to thank the author for a very interesting and stimulating paper. There was much that I found agreement with, in particular the progressive move away from time series-based risk models towards market-consistent or fair value-based risk models, which has arguably already taken place for UK life officers. After reading section 6 of the paper, it was difficult not to conclude that the drawbacks of the former types of models made their continued application almost untenable. I liked in particular the analogy with CDOs in section 9. In section 312, the author highlights various distinctions between operational risk on the one hand and external risks, such as market and credit risks, on the other hand. I wondered, though, whether the analysis and this distinction is quite so simple. For example, two life assurance companies might have apparently identical exposure to, say, equity risk within their with-profits funds in terms of equity backing ratios and the sector and geographical spread of their equities and the nature and level of the guarantees in the funds. However, their ability to mitigate the market risk arising from their equity exposures depends in some respects on their respective operational structures and systems and controls. Their assessments of the amount of capital required to back this risk, and also indeed for realistic basis life firms in the UK, the cost of the guarantees which go on the realistic balance sheets, depends on what credit, if any, is taken for prospective management actions. The efficacy of these actions depends on the systems and controls in place and the decision processes within the companies. It is therefore, I believe, important that companies assess capital required with and without allowance for management actions and also examine the implications of potential operational failures in systems and controls on the capital required. We should perhaps not forget that most corporate failures in the financial world have been caused by a failure in operational control happening at the same time as significant exposure to market or some other external risk materializes. At the beginning of Section 9, the question of whether a distinction between market and credit risk is sustainable in the context of the trend towards fair valuation is posed. While agreeing with much of the argument here, there is still the question regarding own credit risk, that is, the credit risk of the writer of the liabilities, and how that is reflected, if at all, on a company's balance sheet. It's not much use devaluing the liabilities reported to a supervisor to allow for this risk, as explained elsewhere, but the existence of this risk and the ability to default does, of course, create an asset to the shareholders. There is a related point that the market value of any liability depends on the credit standing of the provider. The discussion on tranching in relation to CDOs, also in Section 9, is relevant to the consideration of which or whose risks are being managed or hedged. In a life assurance company context, we can distinguish between the effect of providing guarantees, say in a with-profit fund, on the respective risks borne by policyholders and shareholders in a proprietary company, where in the usual case the risk and reward structures for the policyholders and shareholders are not perfectly aligned. In section 9.62, if I am understanding it correctly, there appears perhaps a slightly unfortunate typo at the end of the question where an X doesn't appear. I thought while this is a useful way of thinking about capital, the spread between X and I think in this case the 0.5% per annum default rate is of course itself a variable which can only be imperfectly measured by looking at market prices. But once again, thanks very much, Malcolm, for an excellent paper.
Any other contributors? Andrew?
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, my name's Andrew Smith. I'd like to join the previous speakers in thanking Malcolm for a wide-ranging and very interesting paper. I'd like to pick up a point that several previous speakers have made, which, if I understood them correctly, were arguing that instead of basing risk management on a market value framework, one could instead base it on an intrinsic or true value framework. And I just think it's worth exploring what that would entail. I think it's, for the examples given, I would understand that the true value is what the market value is supposed to revert to. So perhaps you could interpret true value as, for example, next year's market price. And I was particularly intrigued by Chris Lewin's risk reduction proposal of buying things where next year's market price is higher than the current market price, and selling things where next year's market price is lower than the current market price. And it's, I have to say, it's hard to argue that doesn't reduce risk. Now, the only trouble, of course, is finding the reliable arbiter of next year's market price today. And I face a similar sort of issue when I do a lot of work with economic scenario generators, and quite often I'll visit clients and I'll show them how the market consistent generator works. So, well, you put the market prices in here, and out come a load of simulations of future yields and future equity returns and property returns and credit spreads and so on. And very often the client will say, well, actually, I've got my own view as to how those things ought to move, and although your market-based model says that interest rates are going to do this, I think they're going to do that, and can you put that into your model? To which the answer is, well, technically you can, but it's no longer any use as risk reduction tool or risk management tool, because all it is doing is telling your fund managers they've invested wisely, and the basis for that conclusion is that you've asked them how they should invest, then you've asked them how they actually invest, and provided they're sensible enough to get those two in line, your model gives them a great commendation. So intriguing as it is, the idea of managing risk on the basis of intrinsic or true value, I'm a bit sceptical as to how well that could actually work in practice. One section of the paper that did intrigue me, that seemed to be really new, was the thoughts in Section 7, which is about capital adequacy, and the suggestion that instead of looking at historically based percentiles for setting capital adequacy for financial institutions. One might instead look at distributions from implied from option prices and so on. And it seems to me that would have some attractions, not least avoiding some of the rather long and protracted debates we have about interpreting historic numbers and the temptation to select periods which give a particular set of numbers. But that would also give some practical issues. If implied volatilities rise the day before you have to do your capital measurements, then your capital requirements would also rise, which is not necessarily an unrealistic thing or an unreasonable thing, but it certainly would create new management challenges, which are probably more difficult than some of the ones we have to deal with now. So it's a venturous modelling idea, and I hope that Malcolm or somebody else will explore that further, because I think it has got something in it. Thank you.
President, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Seamus Creedon. I'd like to echo the congratulations of others to Malcolm on the paper we have before us this evening. I'm particularly pleased to see a paper which is broad in the scope of its application and not in any way limited to our traditional fields. Equally, I believe the discussion this evening has shown why the work needs to be taken on. I think of Malcolm's paper as a start rather than by any means a conclusion, and there's a good deal of work to do. For my part, I want to comment briefly on three particular issues of which I have some knowledge. One is the fair versus intrinsic controversy, then taking that on into the Solvency II context, in which I'm involved with the group consultative activities. And finally, to comment on the implications for, be it the actuarial profession or us as professionals. The fair versus intrinsic value controversy has crept into the discussion this evening. It's the versus that is the problem. The points which Chris Lewin made are well supported by the work of Robert Shiller, for example. But the issue is how actionable is one's view of the difference between fair and intrinsic values. I would love to know, for example, at the moment, the relative values, fair and intrinsic, of the English housing market. The analogy I think of here, fueled by some experience, is of playing poker. In playing poker, knowing the frequencies of all the various possible combinations of hands doesn't guarantee that you'll win. But not having a clue as to the relative frequencies of the various combinations is likely to guarantee that you will lose. Taking the debate on into the Solvency II context, which Mike Kipling mentioned, there is quite a lot of controversy underlying what should be the philosophy of Solvency II. The implication that it should be fair valuation based and with capital requirements along the lines Malcolm suggests is by no means a universal view. There are at least two main issues. One is the level of technical provisions, reserves for want of a better word, where there's a polarisation between the majority Anglo-Saxon, majority actuarial profession view, which is to favour IFRS-based balance sheets, and a view which emanates mainly out of perhaps continental Europe, but also on the part of many of the major insurers, which is for something which is not IFRS-based, but perhaps more like the Australian system based on a given probability of sufficiency, say 75%, to determine provisions. A similar debate exists in relation to what I think Mike alluded to as Pillar 1 versus Pillar 2. I'm almost certainly going to oversimplify, but the battle lines tend to be between those who advocate a comprehensive and well-harmonized Pillar 1 regime as the main determinant of capital requirements. And these tend to be, again, the continental insurers and perhaps those with a relatively low trust of the supervisory capacity. In the other camp, I think I number myself and I think many actuaries who believe in a diverse approach to determination of capital requirements, that there is no single magic approach. A diversity of internal models is desirable and is necessarily to be carried out within the Pillar 2 context. Finally, the issues for the actuarial profession, individual actuaries, individual risk managers. I think Malcolm's paper is an excellent, if not necessarily intended, response to Sir Derek Morris's recent strictures, reminding us that we were at a crossroads where we could fall back or could move forward. Malcolm's definitely in the moving forward into a broader range of applications camp. How to do this is an issue of international debate, and it's worth mentioning for those who might not otherwise be aware that the profession is actively engaged with the issue of broadening its approach to the risk management field internationally. There have been two principal developments which are happening in parallel and which are described in detail in the latest issue of the risk management section newsletter of the Society of Actuaries. Very broadly, the International Actuarial Association is, I think contemplating might be most accurate, I'm not sure it's been agreed yet, organising risk management as a section within its activities. And at the same time, a number of universities in various countries, North America and Europe, are promoting an international enterprise risk management institute. You could, but again, it would be oversimplifying, characterize the debate as, is risk management a subset or a superset of actuarial activity? I think that would be oversimplifying. But these are certainly debates and issues in which lots more actuaries should be getting involved. Thank you.
Contributions from the floor. Well, while you're just pondering, I would like to make a few comments briefly, Malcolm, on section 4.6. regarding the implications of fair valuation for defined benefit pension schemes, which was one of the points that you mentioned in your opening remarks. I think the analysis in section 4.6 is extremely valuable for pensions actuaries, and hopefully through their advice will eventually prove useful for trustees of pension schemes and ultimately for the members of schemes themselves. It's quite clear that the advent of very serious deficits on the winding up, discontinuance or buyout basis, whatever terminology you use, which has arisen through the very sharp fall in real interest rates, long-term interest rates, and increasing longevity, and is therefore not likely to go away in the near future. The advent of those serious deficits is giving rise to new thinking about the nature of those deficits. As Malcolm says, are they in effect a loan from the scheme to the sponsoring employer? And this in turn is radically changing the issues which pension scheme trustees and therefore their advisors are having to address. Purchasing credit protection, as suggested in 4.6.3, seems certain to become one of the main avenues to be explored in the future. What is less clear to me is what is likely to be the impact of the Pension Protection Fund on these considerations. The PPF provides a substantial degree of protection to members in the event of employer insolvency, but it also leaves significant gaps. Members' benefits are only 90% covered. There are serious gaps in the inflation proofing of the provisions, and there is an overall cap of £25,000 per annum on the pension covered by the PPF. So the question in my mind is, will trustees feel that there is a powerful need to cover 100% of the promised benefits in their scheme? If that is so, then credit protection could assume an important role. Alternatively, will trustees feel that the PPF, which provides a government-specified level of protection, is sufficient and they need to do no more? My guess is that initially the PPF level will seem very satisfactory to trustees because it's so much better than what existed beforehand, or to be more accurate, what didn't exist beforehand. After a while, and it may not take very long, the step change that we've had on the 6th of April this year will be taken for granted. It'll be history. And more focus will be placed on these gaps in the PPF provision, particularly if inflation should pick up a bit. So while there may be a temptation to ignore the ideas in 4.6 today because of the advent of the PPF, I believe it would be wrong to do so. And I predict that pensions actuaries will need to be considering section 4.6 before too long. Thank you. Is there anybody else who feels moved to contribute to the discussion? If not, then I'll call upon Colin Wilson to close the discussion.
I'd like to make a few comments on the paper, as well as highlight what have seemed to me the key themes of tonight's discussion. I've been intrigued by the profession's push into the supposedly new field of risk management in recent years. And I must admit, I've always thought that financial risk management is exactly what actuaries do. So maybe there's an echo of Seamus's question about subset or superset here. The wide-ranging nature of tonight's paper seems to bear me out. I think there are a few areas of actuarial endeavour which are not at least touched on within the paper. However, the author rightly points out that it is not just actuaries who are involved in financial risk management. So a theme tonight, which again brought out by Seamus, has been the extent to which actuaries are the most appropriate people for this work. And I'll come back to that in a minute. Obviously, one area of focus was on the sort of continuing theme of difficulties with defining fair valuation itself and differences between that and intrinsic value or true value. Whilst I have some sympathy with Andrew Smith's comments on this, I think the use of next year's price to define true value was somewhat of a caricature. I don't think that's what Chris Lewin said. It was more effectively a value to which it would be reverting at some point in the future. There's clearly no... You can't define the point at which it happens or indeed when it gets there, but you can have an idea about the direction in which it should be moving. The paper points out that fair values can be complex to calculate and to understand, that they involve computational subjectivity. I think the debate again tonight about the appropriate risk-free rate is evidence of that. I was interested to see in the paper where the Danish regulator actually publishes a daily yield curve that can be used to discount so-called risk-free liabilities, and to contrast that with the approach taken by our own regulator, who effectively, to me, seems to be saying it's up to us. Whatever our views on the relative merits of fair values and intrinsic values, I liked Seamus's analogy with poker prices, which I interpreted with poker hands, which I interpreted as being a statement that effectively we cannot just use market prices. As pointed out by Con Keating,
we shouldn't underestimate the difficulties in defining the fair value, and indeed the potential that using fair values creates for market failures, such as inefficient capital allocation. Nonetheless, I think the scope for fair values to improve understanding and risk management is amply demonstrated by the example balance sheets for a defined benefit pension scheme in section 4.3 of the paper. Similarly, I think Martin White's comments about their use to in debunking self-deception and misleading accounting are very relevant in this context. And the idea that they would help us to identify the so-called derivatives black hole. Tim Sheldon also pointed out the benefits of using fair value-based risk approaches over time series models, which nobody, I think, spoke in defence of. So I certainly support that comment too. The suggestion in section 4.6 for defined benefit trustees to purchase credit protection on the scheme sponsor, certainly an interesting one, and drew comments from the opener and the president here. To me, this seems entirely sensible theoretically. In theory, this should have little impact on financial markets, as in a fair value world, market participants should already be allowing for the effective debt created by the pension scheme on the sponsor. If markets were perfect, which of course they're not, the only impact of the suggested CDS strategy would be due to any change in the priority order on solvency, as discussed in the paper. However, in the real world, companies with positive net fair value can be forced out of business by liquidity problems, and I think any strategy which this has the potential of doing, making it harder for the sponsor to raise debt, can have a negative value. I'm also interested in the signalling effect it might have on markets if trustees were to do this, and what it might do in practice for the relationship and the trust between trustees and sponsors. There's a complex codependency here, and which is recognised in the paper. In the language of Section 9, the sponsoring company could be considered as providing the equity tranche of a CDO representing the pension scheme. I think the existence and size of this equity tranche must make a big difference to the security of the scheme benefits. I was also very interested in the President's comments about what impact the advent of the PPF might have on the action taken by trustees, and whether or not this might just effectively delay the use of the CDS strategy by them. I agree with the paper and the opener about the blurring of boundaries between different types of risk. For example, in different situations, movements in credit spreads might be thought of as reflecting market risk or credit risk. I also strongly agree with the criticisms of the RCM credit test in the new insurance regulations. This test is clearly inconsistent with that applied for equities. For example, some longer-dated or lower-rated bonds can attract a higher capital requirement than equity. Unlike equity, there's no mean reversion built into the test or recognition of the pull to par. And the test is much more granular than for equity, with creating spurious accuracy. Overall, I think the test is a strong incentive for regulatory arbitrage, as implied in the paper. Tim Sheldon, I think it was, who suggested that Solvency II gave an opportunity to revisit this. But again, speakers suggested that the signs aren't good, that we're going to end up there with a test which is actually market consistent. Other speakers talked about the importance of expense risk and indeed the importance of systems and controls in helping with the management actions, and therefore effectively the link with operational risk within the business. As a member of the Finance and Investment Board, I've paid a lot of attention to statements made by the Pensions Commission, so I feel I must comment on the suggestion made at the end of a section which I haven't got here, I'm afraid, Malcolm, but the one on annuitants and how, when you talk about insurance risk, you need to think about experience rating cohorts of annuitants, and this was also referred to by Mike Kipling.
very much in tune with the thinking presented by Adair Turner in a recent lecture at the Cass Business School. What seems to be less well recognised is that products which achieve this are already in existence. One annuity provider sells a unit-linked product which pools longevity risk within cohorts, while with profits annuities, which pool longevity and investment risk across cohorts, have existed for many years. The relative pricing of with profits and guaranteed annuities shows clearly, I think, how risky the industry believes the latter to be. So I'd like to finish where I began with a thought on what this all means for actuaries in risk management. As the paper concludes, one of the key requirements for successful risk management is a healthy dose of pragmatism. Appropriate use of pragmatism requires a good understanding of the dynamics of the business, probably born from many years of experience. For long-term financial institutions, such as insurance companies and pension funds, who is better placed to provide this than actuaries?
I now invite Malcolm to respond to the discussion.
Well, thank you very much indeed for all of those who have contributed. As with any of these types of papers, if you've been involved in writing them, what you find is the subjects you think are important aren't necessarily the ones that the audience thinks are important. So thank you for giving me some different ideas and thoughts. I'm not sure I will necessarily volunteer very rapidly to be the person who takes this forward. As Seamus mentioned, you know, these things do take a little bit of time to write. Just a couple of sort of closing remarks. There was a lot of time spent on the fair valuation versus intrinsic valuation, and as I said, there was a presupposition within the paper that we were trending towards fair valuation, and if that isn't the case, then clearly a number of the themes that are explored in the paper become more suspect. But it does seem to me, when I thought about it, the idea of fair valuation, particularly in terms of capital adequacy, is what happens when you can't do what you thought you were able to do. So the example that somebody raised, a pension scheme saying that we're not going to wind up and all these kind of things, or an insurance company that says we're not going to go bust, or we're not going to do this, that, or the other. Fair valuation is the mechanism by which you work out whether, if they're forced to do otherwise, they do actually have enough capital. So I think it is important to look at that. It's important to realise it's what happens when you can't do what you want to do, but you're forced to do something different. And it does seem to me that a number of the themes that also other people explored, I did, when I was thinking about the section about credit risk for pension funds, I do think that will be an important way forwards. I agree with our president, Mike Pomeroy, that people will perhaps first look at this PPF and try and work out whether or not that will provide the cover. And it will be interesting to see how that develops. But it does show that markets innovate, and we need to keep up with that innovation. So thank you very much indeed for your comments and for reading the paper.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. It remains for me to express my own thanks, and I'm sure the thanks of all of us, to Malcolm, the author, to Mark, the opener, and to Colin, who closed, and thanks to all of you who participated. It was a particular pleasure for me to have Malcolm's paper here tonight during my presidency, as Malcolm began his actuarial career as a colleague of mine many years ago. So could I ask you to join me in thanking all of those who contributed tonight, but especially to the author. It would be very helpful for those of you who, if helpful to those preparing the transcript of the discussion for the journal, if any of you had, who spoke and had prepared notes, could hand them to Maria at the back of the hall as you leave. I'd now like to announce the details of our next meeting. The next sessional meeting for the Institute of Actuaries will take place at 5 p.m. on Monday, the 23rd of May, when a discussion, "Is there a retirement savings crisis with a pensions reform?" is scheduled to take place. Now, there will not be a paper for this, but there, if you look in the actuary on the website, you'll find a list of background reading, which will keep you going for many hours. And we will have an opener for the discussion. It will be Alison O'Connell, the Director of the Pensions Policy Institute. And with that, I declare tonight's meeting closed. Thank you.